Back in the 1980s, I moved to Japan in order to focus on my Zen practice. My teacher was a layman, so I wasn't living in a monastery like the other international students. I had a small apartment. We used to go there to sit in the evening, weekends, retreats, and so forth. And I had quite a bit of time. Didn't have a full-time job, just a little bit of part-time work. And so I spent a lot of time reading everything I could about death. Zen, certainly, Buddhism, but other religions as well. And again, as much philosophy and psychology as I could get a hold of. And the one writer who stood out for me more than anyone else that I read was the existential psychologist Ernest Becker. And let me just do a show of hands. Anyone familiar with Ernest Becker? Anyone read anything by him? Yeah? He's best known for his 1973 book called The Denial of Death, and a later one, Escape from Evil. And it seemed to me he had a really deep insight into our relationship with death. Sigmund Freud had introduced this idea of repression, the idea that there are ideas, feelings, wishes that might make us uncomfortable, and so what we do, we can repress them, repress them into unconsciousness or subconsciousness, right? For Freud, the main repression that he focused on was sexual desires. And this was connected with his practice. He saw a lot of women, and he felt they were sort of denying their sexuality. But what he realized was repression in a way doesn't work. On the one hand, it takes a lot of energy, but also what is repressed tends to come out in an indirect fashion, what he called the return of the repressed. And so this was the way he linked the hysterical symptoms of some of his patients, his way of understanding what was going on there, that the women had this conflicted feelings about their sexuality, which in Victorian times, you know, they weren't supposed to have. Women, there would be a hard time dealing with that. Okay, so Freud introduced this really interesting idea. Sexual wishes, sexual desires is our main repression. And Ernest Becker comes along and says, uh-uh. The main repression is our mortality, our inability to accept our death. It's been said that considering our own death is like looking at the sun. You know, you really can't do it. It's very, very hard to do it. We naturally tend to turn away. And yet there's a kind of irony there because, of course, the sun is what gives us the light and has really created all life here on Earth. And Becker's point was that actually our inability to accept our mortality has enormous implications for how we live. In fact, tends to poison how we live. He says, okay, we can't accept our own death. We tend to repress it. But it tends to come out in sort of indirect ways. Our concern to immortalize ourselves. Of course, children would be one way, but also maybe to create great works of art, for example, that would live after our day. One of the great American poets was talking about Michelangelo. How can he be dead who lives immortal in the eyes of men, right? Right? The sense that somehow we might symbolically become preoccupied with trying to immortalize ourselves. But Becker's main point was that this really, in a way, it makes us compulsive, it makes us obsessive. It's like we can't really live fully. The idea being that our inability to accept our mortality is our inability to live as fully because we're preoccupied with death. It kind of casts a shadow over everything. Now, I'm reading all this stuff, at the same time that I'm doing a lot of Buddhist meditation, a lot of Zen meditation. And this is starting to sort of raise some questions, right? One of our main ways of denying death, of course, is traditional religion, because lots of religions, the main thing going on there is that they reassure us that, hey, we don't really die, right? Physically, you may die, but there's a soul or something that will survive. And if we've behaved ourselves, that is to say, if we've done what other people tell us to do, then there's the possibility of eternity with God in heaven, that kind of thing, right? Well, we don't have that in Buddhism, certainly not in that form, but there is a lot of talk in Buddhism about sort of transcending life and death. In the Theravada tradition, also in the Zen tradition. And one night, these two things came together for me in a rather painful realization that this was actually pointing to what was going on in my meditation practice, that I was trying to become someone special, that I was trying to become enlightened, because in some way this would transcend life and death in the usual sense. So you could say this was my immortality project. And because of it, it was a kind of, because I was also fearing death in the way that other people were and the way that Becker was talking, there was a kind of compulsive or obsessive quality to the meditation. Very, very definitely what we call gaining ideas. I really wanted Kensho, I really wanted enlightenment, right? Because I think somehow it was going to help me deal with this or transcend my mortality. As I said, this was a very painful experience, but also in the long run, there was something quite liberating about it, in the sense that it freed me from that to a large degree. But also, as time went on, something else became clear to me, that from a Buddhist perspective, what Becker said was not quite right. It was almost right, but not quite right. Right? It's like, you could say Becker is still taking the self for granted and talking about we're terrified of what's going to happen to us in the future. But Buddhism talks so much about right here and now, and the fact it's not that the self is something that's going to die in the future. In fact, Buddhism sort of deconstructs the self, right? There's this strange but very important idea in Buddhist teachings that the sense of self is not real, right? This is the anatta teaching. And that somehow this anatta teaching is very much connected with the main theme of Buddhism, the main concern, which is dukkha and letting go of dukkha. Dukkha, of course, is the word usually translated as suffering, right? The Buddha, the Four Noble Truths are all about suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, the path to end suffering. And the Buddha said as much, that what he had to teach was dukkha, suffering, and how to end it. The Pali Canon, the earliest teachings, talk about different types of dukkha. There's the dukkha due to mental and physical pain. There's the dukkha due to impermanence. The impermanence of everything and everyone we love or are attached to, including ourselves. So that would include Becker's concern about mortality. But there's another kind of dukkha as well. The dukkha that's described as due to conditioned states. What does that mean? Well, often it's understood in terms of karma. Karma from past lifetimes is going to lead to suffering and so forth. But the other thing that's important to remember is that the whole self is something in Buddhism, it's conditioned. There's so many teachings in Buddhism about conditioned, about fabrication, about, as I would say, constructedness. The fundamental teaching about self seems to be, in modern terms, that the sense of self is not something real, it's not something self-existing, rather it's a construct, as I've mentioned in many of my previous talks. It's a psychological, social, and linguistic construct. Right? Psychological, because what it refers to is the way that mostly habitual ways of thinking and feeling and acting and reacting and remembering. These are all processes, mental and physical processes. It's the way that they work together that creates and sustains our sense of separate self. The idea that somehow there's a me inside that's separate from you and the rest of the world. It's also a social construct because that's what happens as we grow up. We learn to see ourselves in the way that everyone else sees us. Our mother looks us in the eye and calls us by our name, and we learn to think of ourselves as selves. We learn to see other people as things, special kinds of things to be sure, but things, right? And a lot of this is connected with language, right? Language, so we have a term for cup, and we have a term for self, or we have a term for David, and so we assume there must be something there that corresponds to the name David, just like there's a cup that corresponds to the word cup. Now, why am I going into this? Because what became clear to me after a while, that for Buddhism, if we want to use this language of repression, the fundamental repression, it seemed to me, and still seems to me, is not fear of death, although we often understand it that way. The fundamental repression is something more immediate, right here and now. That is to say, the fundamental repression is that the sense of self is not real, that it's a construct. What do I mean by this? Or how do we actually feel it? Growing up, we learn that we are a special kind of thing, and yet, in some way, when we look inside ourselves and if we try to find or locate or identify this thing that we supposedly are, we can never find it. What I'm saying is I think there's a tension between, on the one hand, we're supposed to be real. Our names, other people relate us. We learn to think of ourselves as real and everyone else is real. But at some deep level inside us, there's a kind of fundamental insecurity, fundamental discontent, fundamental dissatisfaction. So, if we look at it in this fashion, it seems to me that's the fundamental repression, some awareness, some fundamental basic insight into the fact that we're not real or self-existing. The contrast between that and the way that we pretend to be. We're always playing roles, and we often get attached to those roles because they give us a kind of security. But the fundamental teaching here is that this sense of self, because it's fundamentally ungrounded, is inherently insecure. It's inherently uncomfortable. Its nature is to be dissatisfied. And this is really important because otherwise we might really misunderstand dukkha, and I think this is a very important part of it. I mean, if we understand dukkha simply as suffering, well, hey, actually, there's not a lot of suffering in my life in the traditional sense, you know. Okay, I had to go to the dentist and spend a lot of money getting my teeth fixed up, but thank goodness for modern dentistry, it's all taken care of, right? No pain, you know. Dentists, doctors. On the one hand, I have a pretty comfortable life day to day, and my guess is most of us here do. So sometimes it's hard to connect the fundamental Buddhist teaching about life as dukkha with our day-to-day life. But what this points to is, I think, the most fundamental repression of all, that there's this kind of discomfort that we don't understand, and what we tend to experience it as is as a sense of lack. So what I'm saying is something very simple. We have this sense of self that's constructed. It's something that we've learned, we've been socialized into it by growing up. We have this sense of self as something ongoing. And what I'm saying is very simple, but I think really very Buddhist and also very, very meaningful. That this sense of self is shadowed or we could even say haunted by a sense of lack. And I think this is a fundamental claim about our human condition, that it's the nature of the sense of self, insofar as we have a sense of separate self, which is inherently ungrounded, ungroundable, inherently insecure. Insofar as we have a sense of separate self, this self is haunted by a sense of lack, by the feeling, by the sense that something is wrong with me, something is missing, isn't quite right. Or, especially in the US, I think, I'm not good enough. I think that's kind of, for maybe most of us, the fundamental way, or one of the fundamental ways that comes out. I'm not good enough. Does this make any sense? So I'm offering this as a way to understand the deepest kind of dukkha, the deepest kind of suffering, which we should understand in the broadest sense, not just pain, not just impermanence, but this fundamental sense of dissatisfaction that tends to permeate our lives, right? And here's where it gets tricky, I think. So we have this sense of lack, but normally we don't really have much insight into where it comes from. We all grow up. I think what I'm claiming is we all have this sense of lack. We all have the sense that something is wrong with us. But in the process of growing up, how do we understand it? Well, I think we're conditioned. We're conditioned by our society in maybe 1,000 years ago in Europe. How would people have understood their lack? Well, that was the function of religion. You could maybe wonder if religion is actually, the fundamental role of religion is to help us, is to give us an explanation for our lack. So if you grew up 1,000 years ago in medieval Europe, what did you have? You had a church, a Catholic church, that told you, that explained where your sense of lack came from. You sinned. Not only your own sins, but you inherit the original sin of Adam and Eve. And so that's where your sense of lack is. But don't worry, if you do what the church tells you, then after you die, you'll go to heaven and your sense of lack will be taken care of, right? And that provided a lot of kind of stability and cohesion in that society. But what about in the modern world? What about in the 20th century where we're suspicious of that kind of pie-in-the-sky religion? And we're also much more individualistic. How do we experience, how do we understand our sense of lack? And what I think tends to happen is we tend to project it. We're socialized by the society and it teaches us, okay, what's wrong is, well, what do you think? In this society, any suggestions here? What do we learn? What's one of the main problems that were taught from the very get-go? Sorry? Well, I think that's a bit, I mean, I like that one. I'm a philosopher, but I'm not sure that's the way that it gets conditioned into most people. The point is, a certain kind of meaning is inculcated very early and very deep. Materialism, consumerism, and money, right? I think we learn pretty quickly, doesn't matter how much money we have, we don't have enough. You know, it's quite ironic. I think that's maybe materialism, that is to say money and the things we buy with it, are sort of the number one example of how we tend to understand our sense of lack. This is quite interesting then, because you can start to relate this individual problem, this sense of lack, with our whole social system. Because we have an economic system that preys on that, right? It's not just an individual problem. You could say we have a consumerist society that takes advantage of it, for better and worse, right? Right. And if you think about money, money, the first thing we realize, of course, is that money is just a symbol. Those dollar bills in your pocket or those numbers in your bank account, they don't have any value in and of themselves. They're valuable because it's our social agreement to exchange them for whatever you want. So if you have enough money, you can buy just about everything, right? You can satisfy just about every desire, maybe every desire. And at a kind of root level, at some kind of unconscious level, part of what we're conditioned is to believe that the way to become happy is to satisfy all your desires, right? And if money can enable us to do that, then in a way, money becomes, it symbolizes the possibility of happiness. So no wonder we become obsessed with it, right? And yet the irony is, it doesn't matter how much we have, it doesn't really give us happiness, so then we have to have more and more and more. Does this make any sense? In other words, I think, I'm sorry?
Never get enough.
Exactly. Because money, the desire for money then, I mean, of course we all need money to survive, but, you know, we're talking when it gets a lot beyond that, right? And I think this is what sociologists have been discovering. Up to a certain level, something like $70,000, money can indeed make a difference in terms of happiness. But after that, there doesn't seem to be much correlation between how much money you have and how happy people are, right? So I think money is a really good example. There's a couple others that we also tend to take for granted, but in fact I think can be understood as responses to our sense of lack. And I tend to call all of these kind of lack projects, because they're ways that we become obsessed. We become obsessed with them because at some level, consciously or not, we think if we just get enough of this, then that will make us happy. That will somehow fill up our sense of lack. And the two I'll just say a couple words about are, first of all, fame, right? Because we live now surrounded by screens and media, and because they tend to show us the same faces, they tend to talk about the same people over and over again, we get a sense that the people there are sort of special. You know, you think about movie stars and such, famous people. They somehow attain a kind of specialness in strong contrast to us. And we are, compared to them, we are nobody, right? We are anonymous. But so what we tend to do is we think somehow those are special people, they're real. I remember Freud defined fame as being loved by many anonymous people, right? And somehow at some level, if we can just become famous, then that will somehow make us more real. Again, that'll fill up our reality. That'll make us feel more real, or that'll end our lack project, right? But again, ironically, we also know many cases of people ruined by fame, because I think what often happens is people think that fame is going to change them in some fundamental way. In a way, it just multiplies their problems, I think. And people can't handle it. Right? The third example that I would give is romantic love, which we tend to take for granted, but it's interesting. Historically, if you look at it, you can trace it back to certain preconditions in Europe, the troubadours, the myth of Tristan and Isolde, and so forth. By romantic love, I have something particular in mind. I don't mean, you know, couples falling in love and making babies. By romantic love, I mean something quite special that, thinking of the songs in the early part of the 20th century, right? If just there's somebody out there just waiting for you, and if you find that person, your life will be complete, right? All you need is love. All you need is that one person. And that'll fill up, in effect, that'll fill up your sense of lack, right? Does that make any sense? Yeah? Please.
I just want to add another one,
body image. Body image. Thank you. Right. Good, good. So body image used to be mainly women. Of course, now metrosexuals, men as well. But some, you know, I think it's a real tragedy there because, of course, the whole body image thing, if it's your way of fixing your sense of lack, then you can never be beautiful enough. You can never be perfect enough. I remember, and I think I've mentioned this before, an interview I read with Cindy Crawford, some supermodel, is that right? And she was going on and she was complaining about her own body, that she had a little bit of cellulite right here and it just bothered the hell out of her, right? You know, it's like once that's your lack project, you're never going to be good enough. And so other people, we can add to that. We can add power. You know, some people become obsessed with power. But what I'm offering here is a way of understanding all of these as things we become obsessed with, preoccupied with, and therefore, you know, by obsessed, we lose our freedom. We become really, we have to perfect ourselves in this way. In these ways, all of these become what I'm calling lack projects, reality projects, because we have this fundamental sense of lack. And the basic problem is, insofar as we project our sense of lack outside, what I lack is this. Not enough money, not enough fame, my body is not beautiful enough, my partner isn't gorgeous enough, or my sex isn't good enough, whatever. Yes? Yes, I think they are. Sure. Right. Okay. Good. That's right. Okay, if I can just repeat that, yeah. You will remember that earlier I was saying 1,000 years ago in Europe, there was a kind of agreed cultural understanding of what our sense of lack was, and it was connected with sin. And I speculated that in traditional societies, maybe that's why religion is there. You know, it gives you a way to understand what's wrong with you, the feelings of lack. It gives you a way to respond to that. You got the sacraments, you confess your sins, you go to church, you get the, you know, you do all those things. And it also promises you a future where after you die, your sense of lack, if you lived in the right way, you're going to go to heaven. And if you didn't, your sense of lack will get much worse, right? Right? So, but what's striking is that in the modern world where we think we've lost religion, right, for the most part, it's like a lot of us just don't believe in those old stories. Nonetheless, we still have a sense of lack. And how are we going to understand that? Any culture, any society, in order to function, is going to have to give us explanations for our lack and ways to resolve it. And to be quite frank, I think a lot of the problem with American culture today is that the solutions that are given are quite problematical, right? The solution is to become a multimillionaire or a billionaire, right? The solution is to become famous. The solution is to have a perfect body. I mean, it's like these are unrealistic things, but they're also zero sum in the sense that if you want to understand why we're having this horrible polarity between a tenth of 1% super rich and the, you know, the growing gap between rich and poor, you know, there's very much this zero-sum sense that I have to earn more than you do. Whereas in the old days, if it's a church, you know, you can all sort of worship together and relate to God together and hope to go to heaven together. But being more individualistic, we've also become much more competitive, much more vicious, I think, if that makes any sense. So what I'm suggesting here, just to kind of sum up this little bit of it, is that it can be a very valuable way to understand what Buddhism is fundamentally saying about dukkha, about suffering, to understand it in terms of the sense of lack. And if that's true, I think it's really important for each of us to reflect very deeply, how does our own sense of lack come out? How do we project it? What is it that we are thinking we lack, that if we just had that, then it would kind of fill us up and we would be complete? I'm going to hold off for a bit. We'll have a discussion period, but let me just say a couple more things and then we can open it up. I've talked about this in previous talks, so I'll kind of keep it short. What's distinctive about a spiritual path like Buddhism is that it offers us a very different way of responding to this sense of lack, right? If the sense of self is a construct, and that's my language, that's my way of understanding what Buddhism is saying about anatta, this no-self teaching. If the sense of self is a construct, you can say that the construction of the sense of self is the same time the construction of the sense of lack. And the solution is deconstructing and reconstructing the sense of self. And that's really what the spiritual path is about. By reconstructing, that's my usual way of understanding karma. Right? Now, Buddhism and karma in Buddhism is a very complicated issue. There's lots of cosmological stuff, rebirth. I don't know if that's true, but we can say a lot naturalistically and psychologically, building on what the Buddha emphasizes, right? In the time of the Buddha, people already believed in karma. What he added, what he emphasized, was the importance of intention, our motivation. That's what creates karma. When you act in a certain way, when you're motivated in a certain way, that's what creates karma. And what I think he's pointing to there is an extraordinarily profound spiritual truth. Something like this: if you want to change the quality of your life, if you want to change how you experience the world and how other people experience you and respond to you, there's a very simple way to do that. Not always easy, but very fundamentally simple, and it's simply this: transform your motivations. If you're motivated by what Buddhism calls the three poisons, greed, ill will, delusion, you're going to create problematic situations for yourself and other people. But if you are motivated by generosity, loving wisdom and loving kindness, and the wisdom that recognizes our interdependence, our interconnectedness, then you're going to be experiencing the world in a very different way. And other people will tend to pick up on that, and they'll tend to respond to you in that way. I mean, that, I think, is the most fundamental teaching. Honestly, I don't know if cosmological karma is true. In the most fundamental sense, I don't care, because if I live according to this insight of the Buddha about transforming our motivations, that'll take care of itself. I don't have to worry about what happens after I die, right? So that's my understanding of reconstruction, is transforming our motivations, in which case we will be experiencing the world in a different way, right? From this perspective, we're not punished for our sins, but by them. Even though that language is not really very Buddhist, right? And likewise, Spinoza put it so well at the very last verse or line of his Ethics. He said, "Happiness is not the reward for virtue. Happiness is virtue itself." You know, understanding virtue in a broad sense, the positive motivation. Does that make sense? I find that really profound, you know. That's the deconstruction. Sorry, that's the reconstruction. The deconstruction is, well, what's going on when we're meditating? If the sense of self is, as I said, composed of the way these habitual patterns and ways of thinking and feeling and acting and reacting and remembering, and if it's composed of these habitual patterns and the way that they work together, well, hey, when we're meditating, we're not acting on them. Those thought patterns, those tendencies arise in the mind, but we don't act on them in the same way, right? If I'm watching the Super Bowl, or maybe I should say the World Cup, the finals, right? Sunday morning, anybody else? If I'm watching the finals, good game, wasn't it? If I'm watching the finals and then there's a thought, oh, a beer would taste really good right now. You know, I can go and get the beer and drink it while I'm watching the game, and didn't even know I drank it, right? That was kind of thing. But if I'm meditating and the thought, wouldn't a beer taste really good right now, right? Well, I have two choices. I can get up and get the beer, in which case I'm not meditating anymore, or the thought comes, but I don't identify with it, I don't act on it, the thought comes and it goes. And that's the same way with everything else. So meditation can really be understood as disidentification from all those habitual patterns, which is, in effect, deconstructing the sense of self. And, of course, what Buddhism talks about is the possibility of some kind of awakening or liberation from the sense of self and the lack and the dukkha that is associated with it. The fundamental idea being, according to what I've said, that the fundamental delusion is the sense of a me that's somehow in here and the rest of the world is outside. But if I can let go of the thought processes that maintain, reinforce that sense of separation, then there can be a kind of an opening where I forget myself and I realize my non-duality, my intimacy with the world. And, you know, this is one way to understand. Certainly the way Zen is talking, right? What did Dogen say, right? To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self, to let go of ourselves. To forget the self is to realize your intimacy with the 10,000 things. That is to say, letting go of this sense of separation between me inside and the non-self that's outside. So Buddhism, I think, just to wrap it up here, Buddhism, I think, gives us this wonderful way of, alternative way of understanding what it is that bugs us, you know, this sense of lack, this other way of understanding how we have been understanding what the problem of our lives is. And rather than trying to just always get more and trying to fill up a bottomless pit, which we can never do, Buddhism offers us an alternative, as it were. We take this all back into ourselves. Instead of projecting our lack outside, we meditate. Sometimes it's not all much that fun, you know. It can be painful, certainly boring. But in the process of doing that, we're not projecting our sense of dissatisfaction, but we're sort of, as it were, letting go of it, because it's the shadow, it's the other side of the coin from the sense of self. And to let go of the sense of self, therefore, is to let go of the sense of lack and to realize something profound about our non-duality with the world. Does that make any sense? Some questions, yes, sir, or comments. And if you can speak really loud, because people over there otherwise won't hear you. Well, searching can mean a lot of different things. I mean, in a way, you could understand Buddhist practice as another kind of lack project, but one that can actually undo itself and sort of end itself, if that's what you're pointing at. One can, of course, drink the beer more mindfully or less mindfully, right? So the problem with watching a football game is that it tends to become less mindful because I'm focused on the, you know, glug, glug, you know, so easy to do that. It's definitely the case that there is this practice of doing everything we can mindfully, but I wouldn't want to confuse that with the actual meditation when literally we're doing nothing. In a way, we were doing that before, right? We're literally doing nothing except anything that arises in the mind, we don't identify with it, whether it's a beer or anything else. So I'm not saying drinking beer is always bad. You know, maybe there's a time and a place for it, but that's not the same as the meditation. Yeah. Yes, sir, in the back.
Beer drinking meditation is such a Colorado thing.
Just you know, my own practice has been Zen, so I'm a little wary about evaluating insight meditation, although I'm aware of, you know, some types. The practice that I learned was based on what my teacher said, Yamada Cohen. He said that the practice is about forgetting yourself in the act of uniting with something or becoming one with something. And that's the way we were taught to work on the koan mu. What we really did, koan mu, is there's a question built into it, but the really important practice is to repeat the sound, not out loud, but in your mind, along with exhalations, just moo, 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 moo. And if you do that, say, over a week retreat, with very few distractions, maybe none, except your own mind, right? So something happens, you see. It's like there's only moo. After a while, the other thoughts tend to fade away because you're focusing on moo. And if you continue more, what happens is the sense that there's a self, a me, a consciousness that's saying moo, and moo is an objective sound, that sense of separation tends to fade away so that you become one with the sound of moo. And in Zen practice, we say, in this stage, moo stands up, moo sits, moo goes to the toilet, moo walks around the zendo. You literally use moo as a way of letting go of everything else, and insofar as all those things are what compose the sense of self, in the process of letting, in a way, you're letting go of your sense of self, you see. And then there's the possibility of some kind of opening then. Now, that's not the only Zen practice. There's also Shikan Taza, when you don't focus on anything in particular, which is quite difficult because the mind usually just tends to kind of wander all over the place. But, I mean, that's one good way. You're not focusing on the lack. You're focusing on deconstructing the sense of self. And because the sense of lack is the shadow of the sense of self, by deconstructing the sense of self, you're also deconstructing the sense of lack. Yes, please, and then John. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't see that as different from what I was talking about. My own teacher would talk about realizing your essential nature, which would be another word for what you said. But the essential nature is not dualistic, you see. In other words, the whole concept of self has meaning only in relation to a non-self. Maybe that's the important thing, that there is a sense of separation. The self is in here, the non-self is out there, right? And that's a delusion. That's the kind of the fundamental, the most basic delusion, that this self inside is somehow separate, has some separate reality from the rest of the world. And when in the practice and in an awakening experience, you sort of, that sense of separation can dissolve, then that would be realizing our essential nature, realizing our true face before our parents were born. So there are different ways of pointing and describing the same thing. John, please.
Ananda says to the Buddha, "This teaching of not self is subtle. It is difficult to penetrate. It is for the few, not for the many." The Buddha says, "That is so, Ananda, you are right." So it's not an easy doctrine. Dukkha, from Sanskrit, is the opposite of sukra, which is sweet. So the origin of the word sweet in many languages, sukra, French, comes from Sanskrit. The flip side of that is dukkha, which is sour. So one way to understand the First Noble Truth is not that life is suffering, but the condition of the unlightened mind is unsatisfactory, or has a sour aftertaste, dukkha, sour. So from the standpoint of an enlightened being, you could see that the unenlightened mind is unsatisfactory and sour. I've often wondered whether many people have the intuition that there could be a different state, a state of bliss, a state of peace, a state of contentment, a state of security, a state of not needing anything else beyond what is there for fulfillment. But if there is that intuition, but then it's misguided, and somebody's looking for the state of bliss in the wrong place, then maybe you're going to have alcoholism, maybe you're going to have infidelity, maybe you're going to have drug addiction, maybe you're going to have gluttony, maybe you're going to have theft, maybe you're going to have ego grasping. So if there's a sense that, yes, there could be something much better and beyond what we have, but we look for it in the wrong place, then my analogy for that is it's climbing a poison ivy vine looking for ripe mangoes at the top of a rubber tree. And I think that perception is what gives rise to the compassion of the Buddha saying, teach, because here are these people seeking their welfare and happiness in the wrong place. So I think one of the repressions is the intuition that there could be a state of bliss, but searching for that in exactly the wrong direction. And so that produces a lot of sourness, discontentment, unsatisfaction.
Isn't there a Rumi story to that point where Rumi is looking under this light, the street light, right? He's looking for something, and somebody else comes around and says, what are you looking for? He says, I'm looking for this coin that I lost. And the friend points, he helps him for a while, and he says, how did you lose it? And he said, well, I was over there, and it fell out of my pocket. He said, well, if it fell out of your pocket over there, why are you over here? Well, this is where the light is. Right? Yeah. Yeah. The, you know, following up a little bit about this issue of, in my tradition, we talk a lot about, maybe too much, about Kensho, this first glimpse or first opening, this first taste of awakening, where something happens because for a moment at least, we're able to let go of ourselves, right? Now that's not the great enlightenment of the Buddha, certainly, but it's a taste, it's an experience that even if it fades away, even if we fall back into the old habits because those old conditioned ways of thinking and acting, and I mean, they don't just disappear because you have a little taste of this, but nonetheless, this little taste of non-duality or awakening, it can be really powerful because it kind of shows you the way forward. It shows you, first of all, it's reassuring that there is this possibility, but it also gives you some sense of, some deeper sense of where to go and how to pursue the practice in order to experience more deeply and undo those kind of problematic things. So certainly in Zen, it's not either or in the sense that you're now going to be living in full bliss, but it's rather understanding more deeply the relationship between those occasional moments and our normal way of experiencing. And it means that we will be much less likely to get caught up in these lack project games, you see. For a moment, we saw through them. For a moment, and then that insight, that realization at some deep level can be very transformative. We're not going to spend our lives trying to get rich or become powerful or famous, but we know that there's this other way to pursue the kind of alternative experience, which, as you said, John, is very blissful, liberating, awakening. Yeah. Yes, please.
You talked about lack of projects.
Right.
And I was thinking about the fact that the entire process of Buddhist meditation or Zen or whatever.
I think it is. To serve. You know, Joanna Macy makes a similar distinction where, you know, some people understand the spiritual path is all about transcending this world, you know, this messy world of samsara. But there's another way to understand the spiritual path is really getting more deeply into it and really not, I mean, just in terms of what I said, it's sort of, if the delusion is sense of separation, fundamentally, and if we overcome that, well, what happens? Do we transcend the world, or are we rather more, in a sense, a part of it? And what does that mean? What does it mean to wake up from one's own lack projects into a society full of people obsessed with lack projects? You know, oh my God, you know, how sad, and the suffering that creates, and not only on the individual level, but on the collective level, the kind of institutions we have that often encourage that, and tribalism, and so forth. And it really means entering more, because we're not needing to protect the self, because we're not needing to find something that's going to fill up myself. If we can let go of that, then we can engage more deeply. And I think it implies more social and ecological engagement with what's going on in the world. Because what else is there to do? I mean, the whole idea of lack project is the meaning of my life is me filling up my sense of life, securing myself, and it's very narcissistic, ultimately. And if you let go of that, you're in the world, well, what's going on? There's a lot of dukkha, there's a lot of suffering, there's a lot of lack projects, and the issue is really, okay, where can I engage in a way that's going to make a difference, that's going to help? You know, and depending on the kind of person we are, the situation that we're in, then, you know, there are various possibilities that come up. But all that's a gloss on what you said. I think that's exactly right, that it's not about escaping this world except in a very, very symbolic way. Rather, it's deeper, non-dual engagement with it. David? Yes, ma'am. Yes, please. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
So I totally agree with all the deconstruction and bringing ourselves, you know, into connection rather than separation. But one of the things that has been mentioned yet is what's really helpful for me is to be in nature. And when I sit and just allow myself to allow that separation to disappear between myself and my surroundings and nature, and then it's all there, you know. There's no separation, there's no lack. It's just we're all the same. And then that can begin to happen with other people and with us, the whole construct of community and everything. And then there is nothing left but service. That's it. So I just think nature, mm-hmm. That whole is a real key.
Have you been up to the Eco Dharma Center? Come visit us. I mean, it's interesting, the Buddha spent most of his life outside, right? I mean, I think that's exactly right. And one way to elaborate, maybe I'll end with this, is our sense of time is connected with this. When we have a sense of lack, it's always going to take us out of the present, because when we're in the present, we feel the sense of lack. We're always going to be future-oriented because we have these projects. Sometime in the future, we'll get enough money, enough fame, whatever. So it always tends to take us out of now and project us into the future. But if you go and sit under trees or out in a meadow, you know, you're in a different environment where that way of thinking is not encouraged. I think it is encouraged in big cities when we're surrounded by other people doing the same thing. But if we can get out in the nature and we can kind of breathe, and the whole sense of time and the present expands. And when we're future-oriented, there's always a sense of separation, because it's my sense of, yeah. Maybe that's a good place to stop. Thank you. Thank you all.